2-2 pitch. A swing and a long drive. Deep left. Way back. Gone.
Hey, everybody. JJ Cooper, Carlos Collazo here. We did a mock draft a few weeks ago, and so much has changed. So much has happened since then. We have another mock draft 2.0 up at baseballamerica.com. And Carlos is here to talk about it. So, Carlos, great to see you. It was great to see you in person last week. We were actually at the same event. We had NHSI last weekend, which is, if you don't know, the National High School Invitational, which is put on by USA Baseball. It is always a great event, but I would say that this year it was even better than normal because you don't often have a team at the event that's going to have three potential first-round picks. We had that. We had some other guys who stand out who are also potential first, second-round picks there. But how are you doing? And before we kind of get into this mock draft, how was NHSI for you?
Yeah, I'm doing good. Glad to be back here talking about another mock. And like you said, the NHSI was great. I think it was one of the best weeks I've had in terms of just being at the field and being at games and talking to people. The talent of the NHSI is always worth going to see, but I think for what I'm doing specifically around this time of year, I get as much value from just talking with the scouts, the cross checkers, the directors, the higher ups who are at fields walking around. Like, you get a great pulse of what's going on in a draft class because really a large portion of the industry has descended on Cary, North Carolina to see all these high school players, to get looks at players who are pushing up boards or to get looks at players who have already been at the top of draft boards. There was also a lot of stuff kind of around the area outside of the event that people were in for, some college series that were heavily scouted, some other high school players who were not in the event but close by. So it's always a great event. It was good to see you, see some of the other BA guys in person. And it really fueled, I would say, a lot of this. Yeah, we had four people at the Corona game when Seth Hernandez was on the mound. But yeah, I would say this mock draft was fueled in large part from the conversations that came from NHSI.
So it has been just a little bit over a month since we did our last of these for a podcast, you know, for the website and a podcast and a video. March 12th, I believe it posted on YouTube. We've got the, you know, you can click on this if you're on the right, you know, some YouTube, you can't do it on your TV, but you can if you're watching this on your computer. We'll have a link for that. But the key first question is this. So what has changed since then? How is the draft, you know, the entirety of the draft, you know, the players moving up and down? What is kind of, has anything kind of become more clarified since then? Or has it become even maybe a little bit cloudier?
Well, I'd say the one thing that we had to mention that has absolutely changed is the draft order itself. We have the Red Sox picking 33 after their trade with the Brewers. You can trade supplemental round picks. So the fact that we had a mock draft prior that doesn't even have an accurate order is just one of those funny little wrinkles of baseball's draft. But yeah, I think in large strokes, nothing significant has changed. And I think the industry probably, like, there are a lot of moving parts, I would say, throughout the middle of the first round and back of the first round. A lot of new names, a lot of guys pushing up. But at the very top, it's still a lot of uncertainty for the teams picking at the top. I think teams have been a little disappointed with the college hitters of this year's class. No one has really taken the step forward that Travis Bezzano did a year ago, taken the step forward that Charlie Condon did a year ago. Most of my conversations with scouts and teams picking in the top of this class is really them kind of lamenting the fact that there aren't any locked in, no doubt college profiles that you feel really good about from a hitting standpoint. And I think the profile that is mostly filling that vacuum now and really moving up boards at this point is a really strong high school shortstop demographic from this year's class. If we had this same college hitter group in last year's class when it was a really down high school group, I think teams would be really sour on the draft class itself. But the talent of the high school shortstops in particular this year has been really strong. There are a number of players in this mock draft who have moved themselves up board significantly by coming out with increased strength, with better offensive profiles. Billy Carlson's name was all the rage throughout the NHSI. He's the Corona shortstop on that team that we're talking about all spring that's just loaded and has a chance for three first rounders. And so that's kind of how I feel about the draft at this point. Everyone in picking in the teams is kind of really wondering and uncertain who's even going to get to them. I'd say we're still far enough out from the draft itself that this mock was mostly trying to slot players in the right regions of the board where teams expect them to go. I think we have a reasonable feel of like who's going to go off first. But even with the first five, six players, if you feel good about them being the first six, the order itself is going to vary wildly.
Well, that's where this is different. Again, what I'm talking about here is a very rare, but like we have the draft that you and I always love to talk about, the Adley Rushman, Bobby Witt Jr. draft, where at this point in that year, those guys were going at the top of the draft.
Yeah, you could even say the summer before, it was like Adley Rushman and Bobby Witt Jr. were like the clear one too, and they never really wavered from that.
And then you could throw in the CJ Abrams and all that were around it, Riley Green. That, again, mm-hmm. it was a really good draft. But those guys mm-hmm. were like, okay, they're in that mix. But what I would say this year is there's less clarity. Like, those were slam dunks. This is something where, as we roll through this, when we say this person's one, two, three, like, there are other scenarios right now where it could absolutely be seven, eight, nine, because there's enough. Mm-hmm. Like, they're all in that top tier, but it's there is very little. This is being written in pencil right now, not a Sharpie, right?
For sure. Absolutely.
So the other thing with that is the one last time I'll ask this again, like, we're going to go through the top 10 picks and a couple of other interesting ones here. If you want the full thing, if you enjoy this, I promise you, you're going to enjoy everything at baseballamerica.com. We have, analysis and write-ups for all 40 picks to get us to everyone getting at least one pick. On top of that, we also have scouting reports on everyone now. We're expanding that soon again, but we're already basically to where anyone who's getting picked before long, we'll be trying to, besides senior signs, most everyone will be picked on day one and day two. We'll have reports up before too long. So mm-hmm. just check it out, baseballamerica.com. But the last thing before we dive into looking at the picks, is it still the case? When we talked about this a month ago, there was a lot of feeling, like you said, there's a lot of uncertainty if you're picking in those teens or 20s. But at the same time, it really feels like this is a draft where you would rather have, obviously, have more money to spend if you pick at the top, because this is a slotted mm-hmm. bonus draft bonus pools where you have, if you pick at the top, you have more money to spend on whatever you, however you want to spend in the draft. But that being said, does it still feel like that this is a draft where having more picks in kind of that teens, mm-hmm. 20s, 30s, 40s, you're not getting penalized as much in that as you would be in a draft where there was a clear set top five, where you're like, mm-hmm. yeah, you're going to be able to spread it around, but you are going to miss out on that top tier?
Yeah, I think so. I think mostly the teams that I've talked to that are picking in the middle and back of the first round are pretty excited with the options they're going to have available to them, even if they would like to have some more certainty on like who those specific names maybe were, so they could focus their targets and their looks a little bit more. But teams like the Rays picking 14th, teams like the Orioles at 19, Brewers 20, Royals 23, all of these teams have multiple picks. The Rays, actually, we don't have the actual slot values out now, but we're expecting them to have maybe the second biggest bonus pool in the class. And so the drop off in talent from what you're going to be able to pick from top five, top 10 is really not all that different from what you're going to find in the middle of the first round. And I don't know if I said this on the last video we did for our first mock draft, but I think this year's class from 11 to maybe 40 or 50 is maybe more exciting to me than last year's class, even if I'll grant that the 24 1 through 10 group is maybe a little bit more exciting than this year's 1 through 10, or at least has the profiles that teams typically want 1 through 10. There were just so many college hitters in that group that you had a lot of conviction in their pure hitting ability. So yeah, I think so. I think the teams that are picking in the middle have a lot of really quality depth options. And if you're not seeing a significant drop off in the talent through that range, you have to be pretty excited with the guys that you might be able to get a chance at.
So we talk a lot about demographics on this when we talk about the draft, but that's something that teams absolutely look at. You mentioned this is a really good, if you said what is the best demographic at the top of this draft, is probably high school shortstops. That's actually, if you're hearing this and you're going, okay, well, that's not college hitters. Yeah, I would say that, like, if you for the general team, if you said order of preference, college shortstops, college middle infielders are mm-hmm. probably, like, they look at those as like, that's investing in an index fund, right? Usually mm-hmm. going to pay off. College pitchers, especially top front of the rotation pitchers, number two. But I would say the third group, like ahead of college catchers, ahead of college outfielders, ahead of almost any other high school group, pitchers, outfielders, mm-hmm. catchers, whatever. High school shortstops is a group that teams are very comfortable. The success rate on those over the years at the top of the draft is high enough that teams there's really not a team out there, I would say. Like, there are teams who we would say, when we talk about a Seth Hernandez, we're going to talk about, there are teams who are really leery of taking a high school right-hander high, not just 1-1, but high in a draft. There's really no one who's leery of taking college, high school shortstops, is there?
I don't think so. I mean, there's so many opportunities for players in that demographic to not live up to their expectations in one area of their game and still provide value. There's just a safety of the profile. I think in general, the high school shortstop class probably gives you the best upside year to year if you're just picking out demographics. Typically, your best athletes in the class at large are at that demographic. And then for the elite high school shortstops, the guys we're talking about in the first round, generally, you feel good about their defensive profile, and you also feel really good about their hitting and power upside as well. So they really just kind of check all the boxes typically. And this is one of the better high school shortstop groups we've had in a few years, I would say. Maybe not the same sort of top-end talent as you got with a Bobby Witt Jr. and a C.J. Abrams, but about a quarter of our top 30 picks in this mock draft are high school shortstops. And it's becoming more and more, I'm becoming more and more confident that a lot of these guys are definitely going in the first round. Some of the guys who are in that like 15 to 30 range, teams are going to look around and just be really enamored with the overall profiles of guys like a JoJo Parker, a Daniel Pierce, or a Steele Hall.
So, okay, well, let's dive in. So we have at the top of this year's draft, we have the Nationals picking 1-1, a team that has picked 1-1 before and has done a really good job picking 1-1 in the past. They obviously got Bryce Harper, they got Stephen Strasburg. Going to be a little tougher, going to be a little bit more of a decision to make this year than it was when Stephen Strasburg was the, if Stephen Strasburg hadn't gone 1-1 that year, if Bryce Harper hadn't gone 1-1, even a class with Manny Machado, it would have been a shock. This year, it's much more wide open. So who do you have the Nationals taking in this month, Carlos?
Yeah, 1-1, I've got Seth Hernandez to the Nationals. I mean, you saw him at the NHSI, about the entire industry saw him at the NHSI. He really kind of passed a big test for himself this year. And I think we might have the factors and the draft to finally see a high school right-hander go 1-1. Certainly, Seth is as much in the mix as anyone that we'll talk about that's in the mix for this pick now. But you really need kind of a muddled top of the group in a draft class and an outlier high school right-handed pitching talent to kind of get a draft where you'll actually have a chance to have that history. And I think just having conversations with scouting directors and checkers who have seen some of the elite high school right-handed pitchers in the past, like he compares pretty favorably to guys like Hunter Green and guys like Jackson Jobe. And both Jackson Jobe and Hunter Green, we've talked about this a lot recently, JJ, they were top five picks in classes that did not have clear 1-1 obvious selections. And with the benefit of hindsight, those high school right-handed pitchers look like they'd be really good candidates to go 1-1. And so if we wind up having a similar class and down the stretch, no one really puts their stamp on 1-1, it might just be a situation where you take the guy who has the best pure upside in the class and Seth Hernandez. And I think teams have done a really good job with high school right-handed pitchers in recent years. Maybe it's because we have a lot more data. We've got a lot more information about how these pitches are going to profile. Teams can do seemingly a lot more overnight with pitching development. But I think Seth checks all the boxes that you'd want for a pitcher in this range. And at this point, I think he's maybe done the most to kind of make a push for 1-1, if that makes sense.
The other thing that stands out to me is if you compare him to the college pitchers, right? Normally with a high school pitcher compared to college pitchers, you're looking at a lot more projection. You're looking at a lot more the uncertainty bars get much bigger because you're like, this guy's a teenager still, probably going to have to develop the stuff more. How does he hold up, you know, in a workload, a professional workload, all those things. But when I look at the college arms in this class, and you just said, not future projection of these pitches, but just grade out these pitches as they stand right now, he's better than any of the college arms really, isn't he?
I think so. I mean, what was most impressive to me with Seth was his ability to hold velocity over an extended outing. I think a lot of times with high school pitchers, we see them in abbreviated outings and the velocity fades off. But he was 94, 98 for seven innings during his outing at the NHSI. He touched 99 miles per hour in his final frame. We didn't have a single pitch, I believe, below 93. He threw one pitch, 93 miles per hour. Now, he's at the stage now where his fastball shape is getting a little nitpicked, and you might have some questions about how that's going to play, that's perfectly fine. But I think you can comfortably put plus on the fastball right now, and people are going to put grades higher than that, I'm sure. His changeup is a 70 grade offering, and we saw every bit of a 70 changeup in that outing. He generated 10 whiffs with the pitch. The movement, the arm speed, his ability to land and manipulate that pitch is really, it's the best changeup since Dylan Lesko. People might prefer Dylan Lesko's changeup. That's perfectly fine, but it's a double plus offering. I think maybe the one area of Seth's game that you could critique or maybe need to project the most is the breaking ball. He's got two breaking balls, a curveball and a slider. He throws them both with really high spin rates. They're just more inconsistent to me than his fastball and changeup right now. But with like how teams feel about their pitching development, their ability to add or improve breaking balls for pitchers, he has all the ingredients to have a really good breaking ball as well. And he flashed that in spurts in his latest outing. So yeah, I don't really think you need to project too much with Seth. And the biggest question for me with Seth 1-1 versus the college arms is really ETA and timeline. We typically see like the high school pitchers just take a little bit longer to pan out. Guys like Mackenzie Gore, Hunter Green, they were drafted in 2017. And only now are we really seeing them kind of actualize their upside in the major leagues. So if you have the stomach to wait that long, Seth could or should be the pick if you really want a fast-tracked player, which I don't know if you're picking 1-1, that wouldn't be the way I would want to go, but it certainly is going to be a factor for higher-ups for all these teams picking at the top of the draft.
I will say with that, as we get to pick two, if you said a team that probably isn't looking to wait, isn't looking to say, well, let's see what this guy can do for us in 2029, 2030, 2031. The Angels are picking two. And generally with the Angels in the 2020s, their draftees, even if they take a high school pitcher, Caden Dana, we talk about Caden Dana in HSI faced Dylan Lesko in that game where Dylan Lesko was outstanding and then unfortunately blew out right after it. But in the case of that, Caden Dana's already been a big leaguer, which there aren't other high school pitchers from that class who have big leagues by their name already. But with the Angels picking two, I would say that it is unlikely, let's say Seth Fernandez doesn't go one. The Angels don't seem like a team that normally would be as much of a fit for Seth Fernandez at two, right? Because this is a team that likes to move their guys pretty quick.
I would think so, just based on their tendencies. I mean, we're hearing some rumblings already that the Angels are going to prefer a deal cut here at number two. I think it's pretty typical to start hearing those sorts of noises around the draft in uncertain draft classes. But yeah, fast-tracking college guys are going to be frequently tied to the Angels, just given what they've done. And in this scenario that we have here in today's mock, might be the best scenario for them, because I do still think Jamie Arnold is probably the best available college player. He has been really, really solid, even if he hasn't maybe been exceptional like a Chase Burns or Hagen Smith a year ago. But he probably offers, if Seth Hernandez offers the greatest ceiling in this class, which I personally think he does, I think Jamie Arnold is the safest pick. He's a pitcher who could easily pitch in the big leagues a year from now, whether that's in a reliever role or as a starter. He has a pretty solid track record of throwing strikes, pretty safe starter profile. He's got pluses or better with the fastball and slider. He's got a changeup that flashes as well. It's ACC performance. So he's just really solid all around. So yeah, I think this could make a lot of sense for the Angels. And really, it feels like Seth Hernandez, Jamie Arnold, Ethan Holliday, Ivar Arquette are kind of the names that we expect to go earliest at this point. And so I just don't feel confident that any of these guys are going to slip too far down the board as it stands.
You mentioned this a little bit, but this is the tricky part when we're talking about projecting pitchers nowadays, is that like Jackson Jobe is an example, right? Jackson Jobe came out of high school and he had a big fastball and he had like some of the best spin rates on a breaking ball that we've ever seen, right? For a guy coming out of high school. The other part of this is, though, is if you look at Jackson Jobe in the big leagues right now, who's still very early in his big league career, but Jackson Jobe in the big leagues, his arsenal is very different than it was when he was in high school. So the tricky part, like when we get to the shortstops and guys like that, you're talking about hitters where you're like, this is kind of who this hitter is. You hope to improve him. You hope he develops physically and all that. But you're kind of, this is what you see is probably what you're going to get. Nowadays with pitchers, a lot of it is, this is what they are now. But we also know whether they're great successes or it doesn't work out for them, 5 years from now, they'll probably be pretty different than they are right now, right?
Yeah, it does seem like pitchers can kind of seemingly change their arsenals overnight, and what really worked well for them against amateur hitters maybe doesn't work quite as well in pro ball. Typically, we see this with a lot of pitchers at the amateur level who have these big kind of depthy curveballs that don't have the same amount of power as you typically see from big league breaking balls. That's mostly the arsenal change we see. Like guys like Jack Leiter, who used his curveball a ton as an amateur, I don't think he's used it quite as much in pro ball. So I don't know if Arnold's arsenal are really expected to change all that much. Like his fastball has great shape and power and location right now. His slider, I imagine, is going to be a pitch that is continue to be useful for him. How much he continues to use the changeup moving forward will maybe be interesting. If he develops another breaking ball shape moving forward, that would certainly be unsurprising. But in terms of like guys who are ready to go right now, Arnold would be at the very top of the list, and that really fits what the Angels have done recently.
We're going to get to number three and the Mariners picking right after this quick break. Hiring has changed. When we have an opening, we need a way to organize what quickly becomes a very complicated process. That's why we need Indeed. When it comes to hiring, Indeed is all you need. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. One of the things I love about Indeed is how it makes hiring so fast, because it organizes the candidates and allows me to set up every step of the process right within Indeed's website. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. How fast is Indeed? In the minute I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed, according to Indeed data worldwide. There's no reason to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BaseballAmerica. Just go to Indeed.com/BaseballAmerica right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/BaseballAmerica. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need. So, Carlos, Mariners are picking three. And I would say in this scenario, again, no one drafts for need. You know, we make clear on that. But that said, this is set up pretty well for them in this mock draft scenario where it's like, okay, the best college arm, the best high school arm are off the board. Mm-hmm. The Mariners are a team, I think, that can feel pretty comfortable about their ability to develop pitchers, get pitchers later on in the draft, and then improve them. They've done that time and time again. Mm-hmm. But here you are sitting where, okay, the entire buffet of hitters is still available. So who do you have them getting at three?
Yeah, at three, I have Ethan Holliday to the Mariners. I think he's the best high school hitter in the class at this point still. We've gotten pretty solid feedback on him early this spring. He's hitting a lot of home runs with his Stillwater High team in Oklahoma. I don't think that was surprising to really anybody, but just has a really long track record of hitting at a high level. He's got a great approach at the plate. He has just impact power. It's a pretty easy 70 power projection if he doesn't already get to like 70 raw power right now. Just a massive frame. It's a big league body. He obviously has the bloodlines, the track record with guys like Jackson Holliday, what Matt Holliday did. I would be intrigued to see what the Mariners would do if Seth Hernandez was available to them at three. They'd had some people scouting him pretty heavily at his start at NHSI. But I also wonder if they would go with a high school pitcher this high. Like clearly with Ryan Sloan, they took him, they paid him a lot of money, but it was their second pick. So it's a little bit different than a top three pick. So this might work out really well for the Mariners to add to a really strong system that includes a lot of hitting, actually. So Ethan Holliday, yeah, most people expect him to be gone inside the top five in some order, depending on how it goes. But yeah, there's no one I would say that's really pushed Ethan Holliday on the high school hitting front to really challenge him to say, okay, I'm definitely the top guy. That seems to still be Ethan. I think a lot of teams feel a lot of safety with Ethan Holliday's profile, just given the physicality, given the tool set, given his track record. So yeah, he's kind of sitting here based on talent for the Mariners.
So then as we roll on, the Rockies pick four, and we've talked about that. This is the class that has a number of intriguing college infielders, but it's a group that feels a little hard still to sort out. But you do have the Rockies kind of going with the first college hitter to go off the board.
Yeah, if you had a sliding scale of safety versus upside, I think Ava Arquette at Oregon State would be further towards the upside part of that scale. At this point, I mentioned it in the mock draft, but if the draft were happening today, I would expect Arquette's name to be the first of the college hitting demographic to go off the board. He's most frequently the first college hitter who's mentioned just when you're having conversations about who do you expect at the very top. I think teams are pretty enamored with his upside potential, with his athleticism, his ability to stick at shortstop as a 6'5", really huge player. I brought this up to some scouts when we were talking about him. I wonder if teams are going to treat Iva more like a high school shortstop profile than they typically would, because there is a little bit of hit risk still with him. He does have a little bit of swing and miss. I think there are still some questions about how he handles really advanced breaking balls, but just the bat speed and the raw power and the upside that he provides in addition to the performance this spring, I think makes a really compelling package. So he is not like your typical really safe college profile. Guys like Merrick Houston, Dean Curley, maybe provide a little bit more of that safety. But I think each of those players also don't have the sort of impact potential that Arquette provides. And right now, if you're picking at the very top, that's typically what you're trying to go after. So yeah, Arquette, four to the Rockies. It'd be really, really exciting to see his bat at Coors Field.
While you were down here, it was a very productive trip, because the schedule worked out pretty well. So the Cardinals pick 5, and they're picking a player that you got to see just last week as well.
Yeah, 5, I've got Merrick Houston, shortstop out of Wake Forest. This would be 3 straight years where Wake Forest has a player or players going inside the top 10. I think as we work down the draft, you're going to hear us talk more and more about profiles that teams are comfortable with. If you don't have hit tools and offensive offensive packages that you're really excited about, you're going to go towards profiles that are typically safe, typically provide a lot of value in the draft. Merrick Houston is a guy who's brought up as one of the safest profiles in the class, just because he is a no doubt plus defender at shortstop. He's going to stick at the position long term, and his contact skills are just so strong. We've seen a lot of hitters in the past who have really strong contact skills, who that just continues to work for them at the pro level. I think maybe teaching contact is a lot more difficult than refining an approach or adding more power with strength or bat speed training. And so there's a lot to work with Merrick Houston. I think for the Cardinals in particular, they have really put an emphasis on players who can control the zone and make a lot of contact inside the zone. So I think both on talent and with, like, given how the Cardinals have worked in the past, Merrick Houston makes a lot of sense. If you really want to seek upside in the top 10, Merrick Houston is probably not a name that you're going to go with, but I just have heard him so much in this range, and it feels like there's a growing gap between Merrick Houston and another college shortstop like Dean Curley. So I still expect him to go inside the top 10 at this point.
Okay. I'm sorry for some of our, listeners, viewers who understand this already. But I do want to point it out for people who it's a little bit weirder to. This is the Major League Baseball draft, different than the NFL draft, different than the NBA draft. If you're a Cardinals fan and you're sitting there going, wait a second, but we have Mason Winn at shortstop. We drafted J.J. Weatherholt last year, and Thomas Segacy just came up to the big leagues as well and looks okay. So why are we drafting a shortstop?
Yeah,
you hit on the profile part of this. This is a key part of this that's worth explaining to people.
Yeah, you have to draft for talent in baseball's draft. You can't draft for need in the same way you can in the NBA and the NFL. In baseball's draft, you're not despite some players who have moved really quickly, you're not taking players and just plugging them straight into a big league lineup. The hit rate is so low in baseball's draft compared to those other drafts that you just have to take the best player available, and you'll figure out the positional differences later. And with a shortstop in particular, these guys can play all over the field. We've seen it with the Padres. Jackson Merrill was a shortstop coming out of the draft. He was great. He got to the big leagues way quicker. Where's he going to play? He goes out to center field and he's fine. He's a great athlete. He can run around. So that's less of an issue. If you are searching for need and drafting for need in baseball's draft, you're going to pass up better talents, and the pick might not work out for you. So it's really almost every single team you'll talk to, they'll say, we're drafting for best player available. You'll figure out the positional log jams if they actually occur later. One of the best examples I can point to is the Giants took Joey Bart second overall. 2 years later, they drafted Patrick Bailey in the middle of the first round. And there were a lot of people asking, why are we spending 2 first round picks on a catcher? Right now, the Giants are pretty thrilled with Patrick Bailey there. He would go much sooner than their pick if you redrafted that class. He's their starting catcher. Things are going to work out. You just need to take the best talents you can.
So that gets us to pick 6, and the Pirates, who are picking 6th. And again, we're not drafting for need, but I do look at this Pirates rotation right now, and I look at the Pirates lineup. You were on that broadcast we did, the altcast we did this earlier this week, Nationals Pirates. And if I'm a Pirates fan, I'm probably waiting to hear your, you know, you call a name. I'm probably hoping that you call a position player and not a pitcher at this moment. So do you make them happy?
Well, maybe. It is a position player. It's Billy Carlson, shortstop and right-hander out of Corona High. He's definitely a shortstop, first and foremost, for the pro game.
I would say maybe shortstop dash. He's not going to pitch.
Yeah, I would say for Billy, like, if you want a position player, he is that. But he mainly derives his value from being an exceptional defensive shortstop. A lot of pretty unanimously regarded as the best defender in the high school class. You could easily make a case that he's the best overall defender at the position in the class, topping Merrick Houston, who we just talked about. It's huge, huge arm strength. It's buttery, smooth, fluid actions defensively. And I think Carlson, we're already getting into the range of really divisive profiles, because there are some real questions about Billy Carlson's offensive ability. I've talked to some scouts who are maybe a bit concerned about the power that he's going to get to in the future. Then I've also talked to a number of other scouts who look at his track record of contact skills and bat to ball skills. It's a really similar conversation to Merrick Houston, actually. He just makes a lot of contact. He always has. It's a lot of bat speed. And so there are scouts who are confident that he's going to get a little bit more physical as he ages. He's going to add some more power. He already backspins the ball pretty well to the opposite field. And so teams think that there are some tools for him to become a really solid offensive player. And when you layer that onto a potential gold glove type shortstop, and he does have that sort of defensive upside, it's a pretty compelling package when you look around and you're maybe unsure of what other hitters are available here. I talked to a scout last week who was like, yeah, he's a better prospect than Connor Griffin was a year ago. That's who the Pirates took in the first round. Very different players, different physicalities, different tool sets. But if you're the Pirates, you're picking a few spots higher. You maybe want a player that's better than Connor Griffin, who you took at 9 a year ago. And for some people, Billy Carlson is that. I think we're talking about, like, the profiles teams feel safe with. The fact that Billy Carlson is such a no doubt shortstop with those contact skills, he's not going to last very long on the board.
So the Marlins pick 7th, and we're back to one of the more fascinating players in this class, player who came into the year. Don't want to say it was like 1-1, like at a different level than anyone else or anything, but in that 1-1 consideration. So if you're the Marlins, but also we had further down in the previous mock than this, if you're the Marlins and you get Jace LaViolette from Texas A&M, are you kind of excited because didn't think that was going to happen at the start of the year? Or how does this kind of shape up now?
Yeah, I think you're probably excited. I mean, the Marlins desperately need some more offense infused into their farm system. That they have plenty of opportunity for players to move up to the big league level and get into that lineup quickly. LaViolette, really, like you mentioned, he was number one on our board entering the year. He had a really slow start, didn't get a lot of great scout feedback. And then since then, he's kind of quietly been moving along and playing in line with what he's done his first 2 years at Texas A&M, which put him in the one hole for us to start this draft cycle to begin with. He's actually looking at a career low strikeout rate at this point, like just over 20% through 35 games, career high walk rate. So in terms of performance, it's been pretty similar. I think Jace is very much still in this sort of top tier of players who are all in the mix to go in the top 5 range. If he continues to perform and do well, he could easily play himself back up into the 1-1 conversation. I've talked to scouts who don't think that's out of consideration at all. You just look at his tool set, the power that he provides, the on-base ability he provides, the speed and athleticism he has in the outfield, and teams still really like him. So he slipped from where he was entering the year, but he's still very much in play for all of these top teams. And I think as we've worked down past the hitters we've already mentioned, there are not a lot of other hitters who are really challenging to go in front of him as it stands today.
He also, when we talk about guys who would probably move pretty quickly, he fits in that group of the probably faster movers of this first round, right?
I would think so. You don't have to project on him physically or power-wise. Like, he's got the sort of physicality that you need at the pro level. I think he has an advanced approach at the plate. Now, if he does come into the pro game and really the strikeout rate balloons, maybe that's a question where you just need some more time against, like, better pro arms. But yeah, he would be a guy that wouldn't shock me if he moved quickly. But he doesn't have the sort of, like, hit tool, like a Nick Kurtz. Like, it's not going to be a sort of hitting profile to that, but he will offer a lot more defensive value than Kurtz will.
I kind of would say it's kind of like it's a different profile, but like Jack, you know, like Jack Caglione faced hit tool questions, but still is in double A to start this season this year, you know, because again, when you jump from that kind of production at a power conference school like that, you're going to move pretty quickly because you've seen a lot of good arms too.
For sure.
Blue Jays here at number 8. I find this a fascinating pick because I do feel like that this is one of those. Also, when you talk about players who I do feel like are seem to be steadily improving their stock. Is that the case here?
Yeah, with Eli Willis, I mentioned this a few weeks ago on a podcast with Ben Badler, Future Projection, if you guys haven't heard that, but he's kind of a sleeper for me for 1-1, just because I think Eli Willis checks a whole lot of boxes for teams. Even if he maybe doesn't have the best tool at any given specific tool compared to his peers, but he's exceptionally young for the class. The Blue Jays are a team that has really valued that in the past. Arjun Namala is a pick specifically that I'll point to a few years ago. He was young for the class. They took him at 20 in 2023. Eli Willis is a better prospect now than Namala was at the time. Namala is a guy we have like at the back of our top 100 at this point, but Willis is a switch hitter. He's a really good defender, shortstop, projects to stick there pretty easily. He's a plus runner. He makes a lot of contact from both sides. So really across the scouting card, he does things at a high level. He's got a huge matchup this week with Ethan Holliday in Oklahoma. Their teams are going to square off on Friday. That has been a game that's been circled on the calendar for scouts like in January. So I had mentioned, like, I think he's more likely to go first overall than slide out of the first 10 picks, just because again, the profile is so compelling. He maybe is a better pure hitter than Billy Carlson. Billy Carlson is a superior defender. But you line him up. And for me, I think like, what is the question mark you have with Eli Willett's profile? Like he doesn't have plus game power now, but I think he's got a lot more physicality than some of his other peers.
And
he doesn't really
youth.
Need to have that now. Yeah. He's 17 years old. So I just think he's going to wind up going really, really well. It would be surprising to me if he was available for the Blue Jays and he slipped past that, just given what the Blue Jays recently have really seem to prioritize in the draft. He fits on talent in the top 10. And for me, there are just very few holes to speak of with his game.
Okay. You said he's playing Ethan Holliday's team. They're not playing each other. They're playing, their teams are playing on Friday. But the other thing about it is like, you know, we both have them both listed as shortstops. You're talking, this is much more of a long-term, like Ethan Holliday is a high school shortstop who we expect to be a power hitter who plays a corner, plays third base.
Yeah. Yeah. I probably could have gone into that more for the Ethan Holliday pick, but I think almost everyone is drafting Ethan Holliday wherever he's going to go with the understanding that he's probably not going to be a shortstop in the long term. He's just a lot more physical, doesn't move around like a typical shortstop. So it's like, hope that he can play third. If not, everyone still feels really confident that he's going to profile well in a corner outfield position. That is like just how good his bat is. But for Eli Willits, you're definitely drafting him with the expectation that he is going to play shortstop. He's going to stick there in the long run for sure.
So that gets us to pick 9. The Reds are picking 9. And this is another player, when we talked about it with Jace, that this is another player who was higher up on this in the preseason and now is sliding a little bit to kind of the back of the top 10 consideration.
Yeah, it's Tyler Bremner, right-handed pitcher out of UC Santa Barbara. He is currently our SP2 top college right-handed pitcher in the class. I would imagine on our next draft rankings update that has a chance to change. Tyler Bremner is much more kind of in the mix in the second tier of college arms, and I think Jamie Arnold is kind of by himself in that first tier of college arms, whereas like 4 or 5 weeks ago I would have said it's Tyler Bremner versus Jamie Arnold. Bremner is an odd one because all of the stuff this spring has looked as good as it has in the past. He's sitting with a 95 mile per hour fastball that's pretty similar to what he had previously. He's throwing strikes. His changeup has still been a definite plus offering and gets 70 grade evaluations frequently, but just the performance hasn't been quite as dominant as teams have wanted. He's running a 4.02 ERA against competition that isn't as good as SEC. Like a lot of these other pitchers we're talking about are SEC or ACC arms, and they have better results in better conferences. I still think he's one of the better strike throwers in the class, but there are some critiques of how the fastball plays. He's getting some like fastball shape or deception questions. I think the slider is a pitch that has backed up in terms of performance this spring. That's a question that teams are going to have. And so if he's not really like blowing everyone away, guys like Liam Doyle at Tennessee, guys like Kyson Witherspoon at Oklahoma, guys like Kate Anderson at LSU, guys who have posted, who have similar arsenals, who are doing it in better conferences and just missing bats with more frequency and not getting hit around as much, they're going to start to be in play. And I think for some teams, they would be above him right now. So this mock is kind of like highlighting his, like where he's trending. It wouldn't shock me at all at this stage if he was outside the top 10. But I do think Tyler Bremner has a pretty safe starting profile, and that maybe could be an edge for him compared to some of the other college arms we'll talk about.
That's a perfect segue to go on to number 10 on this board, because the White Sox picking 10, and I know there's a lot of White Sox fans just like, please, we want to hit her. We want to hit her. You hear that way more than I do. But you've got them here taking, I would say, one of the better rising college pitchers in this class.
Yeah, I've got them with Liam Doyle, who's a left-handed pitcher out of Tennessee. As you mentioned, I think White Sox fans are getting really sick and tired of me sticking left-handed pitchers to them. But I think there's an interesting conversation to be had with the White Sox, with their track record recently, with how they've developed hitters versus pitchers. If you feel like your system is weak on hitters, but you haven't really developed bats well, would you rather just add more pieces to that and try and find someone who can succeed? Or would you rather go with the demographic that seemingly you've done a really good job with, guys like Garrett Crochet, guys like Noah Schultz, Hagen Smith next in line, I'm still pretty excited about. And Liam Doyle kind of is that same left-handed pitcher profile. Very unique profile. We've written about it a lot. I wrote about how he's kind of one of the more puzzling pitching prospects in this class. Josh Norris recently had a good piece about just how his fastball is so dominant, but Doyle at this point, I would say, is like trending into the SP2 conversation. If he's not there already for some teams, he's dominated all year. It's 2.47 ERA through 9 starts. He scuffled a little bit in his first 2 weeks of SEC competition. And then his next two outings have been really strong. It's outlier traits on the fastball. It's an odd slot. He gets a ton of run on the pitch. He's added almost 3 ticks in terms of velocity on that pitch. I believe he's still running one of the highest miss rates in college baseball on the fastball. The questions with Liam Doyle is he looks reliever-ish. It is an effortful delivery. There are going to be really wide ranges of an opinion on where his secondary is grayed out. He's got a slider and a splitter that I think analysts and metrics like a little bit more than scouts who are at the game kind of writing him up. But he's done it. He's continued to perform. I think Liam Doyle is a guy who, in non-conference, I was talking to scouts trying to get a read on like how teams are viewing this odd profile. And they're like, hey, the SEC is going to tell us what we need to know. If he goes in conference and he keeps doing this, keeps posting, he's going to go up. He could easily be a few spots higher than this on draft day if he keeps performing.
He's a fascinating one. So we're not going to go through all 40 picks. Again, baseballamerica.com. If you look in the description here, we also have a link to that mock draft so you can see all the picks. But we did want to highlight a couple of other guys who I think are fascinating or worth talking about. So the Brewers pick 20th. And in this mock, you have what I think is going to become probably the casual fans' favorite player in this class in a lot of ways. And yeah, we could start with the fact that, yes, his name's Jack Bauer. Yes, he wears number 24. You know, that if you're old enough to remember the show, that right there, like the fact that he wears number 24 is pretty awesome, pretty fun. But going beyond that, you had a story this week that just kind of laid it out again. You had a story last, there's multiple stories you've written about it. But Jack Bauer has as good as, you know, velocity as we have ever seen in a high school pitcher. And oh yeah, by the way, we've got to add into this, but everyone else in that category, everyone else is a right-hander. Jack Bauer is a lefty. So what do you think about him? And I feel like he's one of the guys who could go, there's a wide range of where he could go in this draft.
100%. I mean, you could say pretty convincingly that he's like one of the most talented left-handed high school pitchers we've ever seen. He has a fastball that's been up to 102 miles per hour. The first piece item Jack Bauer was trying to see if we had any left-handed pitchers who had touched 100, because he touched 100 miles per hour. And we're like, wait, have we ever seen this before? And I don't think we have an official 100 mile per hour listing for any high school left-handed pitchers ever. Like Alex Clemmy said he touched 100 miles per hour in high school. We never saw that. We didn't have it on like Synergy or anything that we could officially say he definitely did. So even then, Jack Bauer was having an argument, a pretty compelling one, that he was the hardest throwing lefty of all time. A few days after that piece came out, he touched 102. And I think we then could say, okay, he's definitely the hardest high school left-handed pitcher we've ever seen. We only have four or five other pitchers from the right-handed side who have touched 102. And so, like, if you're all at 102, Jack could easily say, yeah, I'm the hardest throwing high school pitcher ever, righty or lefty. Oh, and by the way, he spins a breaking ball that's 3,000 RPMs. Like, that's the same range we're talking about with Jackson Jobe's slider coming out of high school. This really, truly elite range that you get. Yeah, that's what I was talking to a scout just the other day. We're talking about Jack Bauer, and he was throwing 95 last summer, and now he's throwing 102, and there's not much more effort that's been added to his delivery. He still has a lot of physical projection left. He's a lanky, lean pitcher that you assume he's going to add more strength. Like, I don't think people are projecting like more velocity to come, because that just doesn't really happen. But maybe it's a case where he gets stronger and adds even more ease to the operation. But he is such a unique prospect because...
Could I just point out with that? Chase Petty's an example of that, right?
Yep.
Which is, Chase Petty is one of the guys on that list of guys who threw as hard as anyone in high school. But when Chase Petty did it in high school, it looked like basically an engine that was running, 500 RPMs over the red line, right? Like, everything was going into trying to get to that velocity. He backed off, the velo backed up, but now he's up to high 90s again, and he's doing it much easier than he did as he's gotten stronger.
Yep.
Bauer's at that 102. Like, if you said he backs off to like 99, he could be really easy at 99 as a 21-year-old potentially.
Yeah, you'd think so. And I think for Bauer, where the questions are going to come is he does have a really spotty track record as a strike thrower. In my mind, I've kind of bucketed him with guys like Alex Clemmie coming out of high school, guys like Maddox Bruns, who had really impressive pure arm talent and stuff and velocity and power. But there were just concerns that, are they going to throw enough strikes to start? How consistent can everything be? Those are going to be the biggest questions and are going to be what makes him more polarizing. I have him here to the Brewers in part because I think it fits on talent, and he could easily go higher on talent. If Frank Mazzucato was a top 10 pick as an underslot, there's no reason why Jack Bauer couldn't be in a similar situation. The Brewers are a team that has really prized ability to spin the baseball, and Jack Bauer clearly has that. The Brewers are also a team with multiple picks, like we talked about earlier. Wouldn't surprise me at all if the team that actually took a shot on Jack Bauer was a team that had multiple picks in the top 40, and they just felt like they could kind of balance out the risk a little bit more. If you're picking first, you don't have a second round pick, you don't pick until the third round, I could see that maybe being a little bit too risky for you. But in terms of pure upside, I mean, Jack Bauer has to be up there with the very best in the class.
I like how you explained that, which is like, if I've got multiple picks, right? If I'm not basing my draft around a guy like Jack Bauer, but he's part of a portfolio, I know that there's a higher likelihood of, again, he's like lefty who throws 102. There aren't, you just don't have analogs to point to and say, well, the last five guys who did this, here's the results. So you've got a little bit more risk there. But if you're saying that as part of a class where you've got these other guys, you're like, okay, we're a little safer here. And then we add this guy who could be really good, it does make a difference than if you said, hey, this is our one pick that we're going all in on this guy who's a lefty from Illinois who throws 102 out of high school, who hasn't thrown a ton of strikes over the years. That might be a little tougher to take. But and then we want to highlight one other pick, because when we talk about, you said this is a class where teams wish that there were more college hitters, college middle infielders especially, who kind of were rising up boards, because that's something that we see every year, right? They rise up the boards. If you produce in a power conference as a middle infielder, college middle infielder, that's a great way to climb up the boards. But there is an example of one of those who you have here at 39, and I think we both would agree, depending on how the rest of the year shapes out, we could look back on this on draft day and say, he's not getting the 39.
Yep, that's Alex Lodis. He is a shortstop out of Florida State. I think you could say that he's maybe been the most impressive offensive performer in college baseball to this point. I mean, he's hitting well over 400. I look at his line right now through 36 games. It's 434, 485, 796. He's got 13 homers, 12 doubles, and he's a shortstop. Like you said, any time that you are a power conference shortstop performer, you're going to go well. Alex Lodis checks those boxes, and he also has tools and physicality and upside that you typically don't get from those like non-elite prospects at that position. Like, there are a lot of steady performers who you maybe think can stick there, but Lodice has real power. Peter Flaherty had a really good piece that went live on the site today that I would encourage everyone to read that really breaks him down. But he's got power. He's always had power. He can hit to all fields with authority, mostly to the pull side. He's got a kind of this like workmanlike athleticism at shortstop. I think he has a real chance to stick at the position. He's got a great arm. He's made a few really impressive highlight plays. And so, yeah, I think he's going to continue moving up. I asked about him with some scouts over the past few weeks. I'm like, hey, is he pushing towards this like Vahiva Aloy, Dean Curley shortstop grouping on the college side? And they were like, yeah, like he definitely is. He could easily be in the first round. 39, as you mentioned, could seem light in a few weeks if he continues performing, even if he just like maintains this performance. At this point, I would be stunned if he made it past the first two rounds. I don't think where we have him on the board currently is reflective of that, but he will be in that range on our next update. But yeah, like the questions with Lodice are, what is the quality of the pure hit tool? He's a very aggressive hitter. He's always been a very aggressive hitter. I don't think he's ever had a walk rate above 8%. He expands the zone frequently. He really loves to swing the bat. So he's going to get some of those approach questions that we had with like a Jack Caglione a year ago, with a Seaver King a year ago. Like, how much can he sort of shore up that approach? How much does he really need to in the future to be productive? But yeah, it's a pretty compelling package. And I would be surprised if he was lower on our next mock instead of higher.
You would be surprised if he's closer to the top, you mean by that?
I would be more surprised to find him lower outside of the top 40 than like pushing back in the first round.
The other thing from a simple how the scouting world works mechanics standpoint that really helps him, as you mentioned, we had Jamie Arnold at the top of this draft class. Now, yep. I don't want to make it sound like he wouldn't have gotten seen otherwise, but if you even talk about early in the season, right, where it may not have been something where the GMs and the special assistants all would have been making a special trip to see mm-hmm. him, but he was on that field when they were going to in to see Jamie Arnold, and then keeps producing, it never hurts. I'll put it that way. Like if you're doing that, as opposed to you have got to make a special trip just to see this one guy.
We call it the halo effect. And it's where, because you're playing with like a really elite prospect, you just get seen more by higher ups, people who have like decision-making authority in a room. And to your point, like if he's being seen much more often, just kind of by happenstance by those directors, those GMs, those people in charge in the room, it makes it easier for him to go off the board in a bigger spot. And he's been doing it all year. So to your point, like he would have been scouted regardless. He's a college player at a power program. Like there's lots of data and information on him. He wasn't going to be unseen. But I do think those extra looks from those key figures in the scouting department really help.
I think it helps him move up the board a little quicker too, because instead of having to convince someone, hey, you need to go back in to see this guy. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, I saw him. He looked really good. And then you are already, instead of it being like a convincing the higher ups have mm-hmm. already been convinced, basically.
Right.
But well, that is, we've went through 12 of the 40 picks in our new mock draft. We'll have, as Carlos knows to his lament, because it's Mark Chiarelli and myself who ask him all the time, when's the next mock. We'll have a lot more of these before the draft rolls around, but it is fun. It's fun to just kind of track it. If you know, we had a link in here for the previous one, if you want to see kind of the movement of this, because guys do move. Like we're not just moving guys up and down these mocks because we want to create interest in them and create intrigue. They move.
I think I was thinking about this the other night too. I think it might be useful just to have like a, at the top of where all these players are going, like kind of a range of where we've had them on the mock, to maybe give you a better idea of like what the realistic range of a player is and kind of where they overlap. That might be a good visual or just more information to have.
I think we will try to work something up like that at baseballamerica.com. So if you enjoy this, I'm trying to put links in there there are so many stories that we referenced today as we're talking about this. I'm going to try to put that in the description. So you know, on your podcast reader or on YouTube, you'll be able to just jump straight to go see those on your computer or on your phone. Because like when we talk about like, you know, a lot of these guys, we try to cover the draft from step one to when you're with the first pick, the Washington Nationals. And there's a lot of that movement that we're trying to make sure that, you know, we're telling you about, like, you know, last week at NHSI, we're writing about it. Hey, could Seth Fernandez be the first prep run, you know, righty to be 1-1. We're talking about like, okay, well, how does Liam Doyle fit into this? There's a lot there to digest. There's a lot to enjoy over at baseballamerica.com. Carlos, any last words before we wrap this up?
Yeah, I'd also say too, we're starting to roll out draft chats for the draft as we get closer. So if you guys have any questions that maybe came up as you're listening, we've got one today as we're recording that maybe you won't be able to get to, but in a few weeks on April 30th, we're going to have an updated draft rankings. Peter Flaherty is going to do a draft chat. So if you guys have questions, want to ask about certain players, definitely throw those at us. And you can always throw us questions on social media or in other BA draft chats. We'd be happy to dive in.
And you can also send them to askba@baseballamerica.com. And I will make sure that, you know, again, whichever podcast, whichever video we're doing, we can also answer them there. So we want to respond to our readers. We want, you know, to answer these questions. A lot of times, we try hard, but it's hard not to get into the weeds of this because we're living it every day. And so sometimes we have to pull back a little bit. We really try to do that, right? We try to say, like, so let me explain why the Cardinals would take a shortstop 2 years in a row, things like that. Because we know we don't expect everyone to be right along with us and understanding every movement, every little tweak that's happening along the way. But we love to answer your, you know, again, we do this for our subscribers. So thank you again. For Carlos, I am JJ. So long, everybody.